This is an ABC podcast.
William Rickard Bell is a winemaker. William and his wife Kimberly are making plans to build Australia's highest altitude winery on Mount Cunobulus in New South Wales, where there's snow on the vines. But William's introduction to winemaking was a harsh one. He was working at one of Australia's most established wineries in the Hunter Valley, and one morning in 2008, there was a shocking accident, an explosion, which knocked William off his feet and killed two people nearby. William was very lucky to be alive, but he received terrible injuries which took him years to recover from. So much of his skin needed to be rebuilt, but fortunately William kept his good looks and his wine-making palate. Hello, William.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
Very well, sir. We got a suggestion for you to come on the show from your friend Kate Day way back in 2010. Like a fine wine, the idea has matured and come to pass. So it's lovely to have you here, William.
Thank you. No, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Tell me, first of all, how you got into winemaking. Was this a family tradition?
No, not at all. My family are very much a medical family. I come from a long line of doctors, and not that there was any pressure for me to follow that path, but I guess I came out of school not really knowing what I wanted to do. I thought maybe I wanted to study. I didn't get the marks to get into medicine, obviously, but I thought I'd maybe go in the back door and do it postgraduate and pull my socks up and do an undergraduate degree first. But I wasn't really committed, didn't really know what I wanted to do. But I was working in a bottle shop in Sydney, and that exposed me to more wine, and I suppose university exposes you to a lot of wine in itself.
Just not good wine.
Just not good wine, yeah, but you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
and then I went on a road trip in university school holidays and ended up in South Australia and just visited wineries and met a lot of lovely people, and that's what it really was about. It wasn't so much the career, it was just the people that I met. I thought, this is a very down-to-earth industry, and it's got this exterior of being a little bit, I don't know, pompous or even old-fashioned. But then I've met all these lovely down-to-earth people who were very passionate about what they did. And
yeah, it's a beautiful mix of science and art, isn't it?
It is, and that suited me. You know, it's funny actually, because at the time because I was unsure what I wanted to do, I went and had some psychometric testing done because I wanted to be told what I had to do, because I'm not terribly good at making decisions for myself. And so I was waiting for the results of those while I was on this road trip. And it's interesting that the results of those came back and said that I should actually do architecture. But, you know, there's the similarities there in that it's creative, but it's also very technical, yeah, and science-based. And I also like the physical nature of the winemaking as well. So, yeah, ticked a lot of boxes.
So you got a job at Drayton's in the Hunter Valley, which mm-hmm. is a very old established winery there, and you were an assistant winemaker. So what do you do there as an assistant winemaker? Do you spend your days up to your elbows in crushed grapes? Is that what it is?
Pretty much, yeah. It's nowhere near as romantic as everyone makes it out to be. You know, all the assistant winemakers around the country will probably tell you that they're actually the winemakers and they do all the work, and the winemakers will be sitting in their offices pretending to make decisions, which is true to an extent. You run the winery day to day, so you make the decisions. The overarching sort of stylistic decisions are made by the winemaker, and the assistant winemaker implements those and is the link, I suppose, between the winemaker and the cellar hands.
So you're not in a lederhosen and a feathered Tyrolean cap stomping grapes barefoot in a big tub?
Not every day.
No. Okay. So it's basically like the grunt work then of winemaking at that level.
Yeah, it is.
Why was the 2008 harvest going to be a different kind of harvest for you that year?
Well, it was wet for starters, so it wasn't actually shaping up to be a great harvest. It was my third vintage at Drayton's at that point, and so you're pretty established in a job by that point, and you understand the processes of the winery, and so you can actually start putting a bit of your own stamp on the winemaking.
So does the harvest time get very, very busy? You got a lot of different things to do?
Oh, it's manic. So, for 2 months of the year, it's a lot of places are around the clock. We used to run shift work as well. There was a night shift and a day shift. And it's the one time of the year when the grapes ripen, of course. And so the fruit when it's ripe has to be picked, and whether that's at 3 o'clock in the morning or not, that has to happen. And so it's busy.
And if it's a really wet season, then it means you have to pick them early or late?
Sometimes those decisions have to be made, yeah, right. And that's a stylistic decision and a quality decision. Sometimes you look at the forecast, particularly in the Hunter Valley, and it's just going to rain and storm, and you think, well, we're not going to pick grapes at all if we don't get them off this week, even if they're not at optimal ripeness at the time. So
this is the time, January that year, you were extremely busy period for you and everyone else in the winery.
Yeah, the grapes weren't far away. We're sampling grapes, we're testing and tasting, we're servicing equipment, we're, you know, getting tanks empty, ready to be filled again with juice. Yeah, it's busy, very busy.
So the morning of January 17, 2008, mm-hmm. What do you remember of that morning, arriving at work and the day's business?
It's just another day at work. You know, you rock up at 8:15 and, you know, I remember I arrived at work and my boss, Trevor Drayton, wasn't in the office. So I went and found him on the winery floor, and he was chatting to his brothers and a few other people on site. And he motioned to me. He said, "Oh, follow me, Will. I've got to go to Newcastle today. So, I just want to discuss what you might get the boys to do in the winery today." And I said, "Yep, no worries. Just hang on a sec, because I had a few things I wanted to talk to the cellar hands about." So I had done that. I discussed a few things with them, and then I turned and followed him. And then, of course, not long after, the explosion happened.
How do you remember that explosion? Is that blanked from your memory, or do you still actually have that moment of the explosion still in your memory?
I can picture it. Close my eyes, I can picture it. It's every split second of it. It's amazing how slow time goes when it happens and how clear of thought you can be. The only thing I don't remember is the noise. I remember just being knocked off my feet and sort of getting up and seeing myself on fire, looking at my arms in particular, which, because I had to use a hand to sort of get myself up off the ground, and I'd put it down into burning ethanol, and so, which is partly why my hand is so badly damaged. I don't think I really understood the full extent and the danger of the situation, but I knew I had to get out of the building and then, of course, find water.
Was your back to the explosion when it went off?
No, it kind of hit me from the side.
From the side?
Yeah.
And as it did so, do you remember you don't remember hearing anything, but you felt the impact of it?
I felt the impact, and I was thrown. It's like if you're playing rugby, you've just been blindsided by a big Fijian winger. Like it hits you and it hurt, physically hurt. And I remember the flash. Like I remember it threw me a couple of metres. Fortunately, I was shielded by another tank, so I'm sure the blast would have been worse if I had been in direct line of that explosion, rather than having the tank in front of me or between me and the explosion absorb some of the impact. Because then, of course, that leads to other injuries, broken bones and various other things, that which would have made it much harder to get out of the building, and then subsequently in my recovery to get back to where I am now.
What do you know now about the cause of this explosion, Will?
I know there was a tank of ethanol. There's a 30,000 litre tank with about 11,000 litres of ethanol, so a big airspace. And there was a welder in the building, a contractor, Eddie Orgo, who died instantly, and he was welding on the tank, supposedly, which ignited the tank and caused it to explode.
Was it labelled as ethanol?
I believe so, but whether that was done appropriately, it's hard to say, hard to remember.
So essentially what happened then was a big tank of ethanol exploded. That's what knocked you off your feet.
Yeah.
And two people were killed instantly. That was the contract worker, Eddie Orgo. And who else was killed by the explosion?
My boss, Trevor, was killed as well. And he was probably only half a dozen paces in front of me at the time.
When you got to your feet, as you said, your hands were covered in ethanol and on fire. Was the rest of you on fire as
well? Yeah, the rest of me was on fire as well. But I just remember my hands, because I'd put it down into the liquid and then looked at my hand. And I guess that was the realisation of what was going on.
What you said earlier suggested that you were kind of oddly calm in that moment.
Yeah, it happened in slow motion. Yeah, like you... I guess it helped that I didn't really understand the full extent of burns and the danger that it presented. So It was uncomfortable and it was terribly painful. And so, and that's probably what was driving me more than the fact that I thought I was going to die, because I never at any point thought I was going to die.
It's a bit, it was a bit like, I have to run to catch the bus, that kind of feeling.
A little bit. Yeah. Well, first of all, it was a stepwise process. It's like, okay, get up. Oh, I'm on fire. Oh, there's the exit. Let's get out there. And then as soon as I got out of the exit, I saw the dam and I thought, well, there's the closest water. Let's go there.
How close was the dam?
It would have been close to 100 metres away, I suppose.
Oh, man. Yeah. So you just legged it there, did you?
Covered that pretty quickly, that territory. We had to jump over a fence, of course, to get there as well.
Were your legs on fire at that point?
Yeah, everything. Because I was doused in ethanol and my clothes and my whole body was on fire.
Was your hair on fire at that point?
Yes, yeah. Horrible smell.
So you got over the fence and then you leapt into the dam.
Yeah.
What was the nature of the pain like once the dam had doused the fire, essentially?
It's funny. It's not as painful as you'd think it would be, whether that's just adrenaline or... But once you're in the dam, I actually had that moment to actually take stock of the situation and then you're looking at yourself and you're like, oh, I'm stinging here, and you look down, there's skin peeling off you, and then you're like, oh, ouch, this really hurts. But it's kind of like a stinging feeling. It's not excruciating. It's just a constant sting that you can't get rid of.
It's horrible pain, but it doesn't torment you then.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's a very good way to describe it.
Was time still going very slowly at this point?
Yes. Yeah, and I was in the dam for about half an hour before the helicopter arrived, but it seemed like an eternity. Yeah.
Were you aware of the deaths of the other two men at that point?
No, not at all. I could, it was almost like I was removed from the situation. I was down the dam looking back on this burning building and then all the frantic people running around the building searching for people and taking stock of where everyone was. So you could kind of gather from the questions and the alarm that there were a couple of people missing, and I assumed as much, given that Trevor was right near me at the time and that I was badly burnt, that he would have been at least badly burnt or still trapped in the building or dead.
Were people aware of your situation who were running around looking for missing people? I mean, there's this kind of moment of madness, but were people aware, once they'd seen you standing in the dam, that you were badly burnt?
I don't think so. I think they're just like, okay, there's Will. He's accounted for. We'll go and find everyone else. So I felt a little bit lonely. I was kind of there. Hello, here I am.
Things aren't
very
great.
Badly burned.
Yeah.
And then it was only when my brother-in-law was working for us. He was a university student and doing some experience at the time. And it's only when he came running around the corner and dived in the dam with me that I suppose people were aware, because he was able to convey what was going on. I was screaming, don't worry about that.
Had you inhaled any flames? Was your throat damaged?
I hadn't. People asked me that. Right. And it's very lucky, because I suppose my palate would have been gone. Yeah. The explosion created such a negative pressure that I'd say it would have sucked all the air out of my lungs, and the air was coming out rather than going in. Because I know subsequently every light bulb blew in the area, just from the change in pressure. There were tanks that were empty but with doors closed, and the doors blew off them just because the change in pressure just expanded the tank so much that they exploded. So it was a pretty big bang.
So you were there for, what, half an hour before the paramedics arrived for you?
Apparently.
How did you get out of the dam?
I was helped out by my brother-in-law and another mate who was standing on the bank chatting to me at the time.
Could you walk? I mean,
I was pretty, I was pretty stiff and sore. Like it was a bit of a challenge. I remember the paramedic saying, you're going to have to walk out, mate. I'm not coming in to get you. So, they pretty much dragged me out. And then once I got to I almost felt like an astronaut, because you get to the edge of the bank and then the gravity of being out of the water made it very difficult indeed to walk. And so they kind of flopped me face first onto a stretcher and then administered some drugs and can't remember much after that.
Yeah. They must have given you, they gave you tons and tons of morphine, I suppose.
Basically, yeah.
So you remember by passing out or something at that point?
I do, yeah.
Where did they take you?
They took me to, so they helicoptered me straight to John Hunter Hospital in Newcastle, where I was intubated and they performed escharotomies on me.
What is that?
It's pretty gruesome. What happens when you get burnt is that a lot of the liquid in your cells is coming out from between the spaces in your cells, and the fluid just keeps building up and building up, and so you puff up, and what happens, that creates pressure on your blood supply and your limbs, and so it starts cutting off circulation. So what they do is they basically get a scalpel.
Cut you open.
And cut you open to relieve that pressure.
It release the fluid that's building up?
And release the fluid, yeah.
But this is all happening while you're unconscious?
Fortunately, yes.
How long were you unconscious for?
I came to about 3 or 4 days later in Concord Hospital. So I'd had a day or two in Newcastle, and then they'd flown me to Sydney into the burns unit at Concord Hospital here in Sydney.
Oh, man. And what did you think when you woke up? Did you know what danger you were in?
No, well, I woke up head to toe in bandages, and that was a shock, and I had a tube down my throat, and...
So you couldn't talk?
I couldn't talk, and so, yeah, I guess that's the big, you know, that's when the penny dropped. Oh, something's actually pretty serious here, but you know, my wife was, she was my girlfriend, my fiance at the time, but Kimberly was there with me. And she asked me, oh, do you know where you are? And I said, yeah, I'm at Singleton Hospital, of course. And she said, no, you're in the burns unit at Concord and you've been unconscious for 3 or 4 days. And, it was a bit of a wake-up call.
Apart from that process you were talking about of releasing fluid, what else had happened while you were unconscious in those 4 days?
Once I was in Concord, they'd begun operating on me, so they'd taken donor skin from my chest and from my left thigh, and they'd grafted my legs and my arms.
Right, so they'd begun the grafting straight away?
Straight away, yeah.
Because, as we were talking before this, I had grafts myself. They waited for, I waited a couple of days. I think maybe that's something to do with the urgency, but
yeah.
Your urgency was clearly much, much greater at the time.
Yeah.
So you're wrapped in, and you'd already had a fair bit of skin grafting already at that point.
Yeah. You'd probably say the majority, actually, from a volume point of view, from an area, surface area point of view.
How was everyone looking at you?
Pretty gravely. and that was a bit of a, that was odd too, because I had sort of woken in this strange situation, not really comprehending how serious it was. And then you see the ashen-looking faces of your parents and your fiancé and your brothers and sisters. And I think that was because they're all in the medical world, they'd know how serious it was. And, of course, their faces looked pretty crestfallen. I was, actually became a little concerned at that point.
What kind of antibacterial protection were you under? Because you're at grave risk of getting an infection at that point.
They are, yeah, and everyone tells you that if you survive the burns, the biggest risk is actually the infections you get, particularly in hospital. So they're all my doctors, and after that, the physios were all saying basically, get up, get out of bed, get better, or you will die because the hospital will kill you. Some of the bugs in this hospital will kill you. So, because you basically got no skin, you got no protection from the outside world. So, the protections they try to give you you're in a positive pressure room. So,
what is that? How does that work?
It's basically a room that has air blowing constantly. So that if you open a door or a window, air flows out. No air from the outside world can come in. So you can't get any bacteria or chance of infection coming from the outside world. And anyone that comes in has to be, they scrub and they wear a moon suit and a mask and gloves and so
there's that astronaut feeling again.
That astronaut feeling. That's right. Yeah.
Oh man, how much? See, the only thing I know is that once you have a skin graft, the weird thing, for me anyway, was the pain doesn't come from where you got burnt. The pain comes from where they took the skin, the donor site. Was that how it was for you?
Yes, very much so. It's brutal. Because they basically get a cheese grater and slice a thin layer of skin from you, from skin that's still got its nerves, I suppose, and that's maybe why it hurts, whereas, my burnt skin, I've lost all my nerves, so... maybe it was hurting, but I didn't have any nerves to be able to feel that pain. So, yeah, and so they'd do that. And then, of course, I've only had 30% of my body that was harvestable. So they would do that, and then they'd wait 11 or 12 days, and then they'd take another layer.
Oh, man.
They'd wait for it to heal, and then take another layer and do the next section of my body, and they did that five times.
Five times?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's... Right, that's making my head spin. That I thought of that much. I had it once, and it was horribly painful.
Yeah,
and it seems like nothing can touch that pain. Really, that's the thing. Like you can be given a lot of drugs, but that pain's still there.
Yeah, and it's hard when it's your whole body because you're lying on it. You can't escape it. And you can't actually just roll over onto one side where it's not hurting. It's just kind of hurting all over.
Are there times where it hurts so much you almost laugh, like you go, oh, this is just absurd, or cry or something, I don't know.
Yeah, look, the pain relief is pretty good, let's put it, to be blunt, ketamine's a wonderful drug.
But that's how serious it was. You've got a horse tranquilizer, have you?
Pretty much, yeah, yeah, despite the hallucinations and various things that come with it.
Yeah, what kind of hallucinations came with it?
Oh, gosh. Actually, my friends all have a book that they, every time they came to visit, they would, they'd all write a message in the book. And there was, at the back of the book is this little quote section of all the silly things that I said when I was under the influence of ketamine.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, thanks, guys. And they remind me. And the jokes start straight away. They're always saying, too soon, too soon. So some of the, I was convinced, for example, one day that there was a nurse walking past with a plate full of medical instruments, I think, ready for my dressing changes, and I was convinced that it was a plate of pork chops. And I, at that point, of course, if you know what hospital food's like, pork chops look very, very, very inviting. Yes. and also, I wake up one day and I was convinced that I was strapped, tied and chained to a washing machine in the basement. And one of my nurse was my tormentor.
Really? I wonder what was making you think that, or generating that
difference. Maybe it was that feeling of being a little bit trapped, because I was head-to-toe bandages. I had a mask on and things down my throat, so I couldn't talk. I couldn't use my hands because they're bound. I couldn't do anything. And maybe that was, you felt like you were chained.
I've heard stories from people, several occasions of people who've been on this program, who've gone through whole alternate lives while they've been under heavy sedation while in hospital. They really believe themselves to be living in another country under a different name. It's that weird thing like in the last scene of The Sopranos, last series of The Sopranos, where you imagine this whole other life for yourself under a whole different identity that seems very, very real.
Yeah.
It's very strange what happens to you, that weird feeling.
It is. And what is... The worst part is when you're in that fantasy world, it's fine because you'd just believe that to be real. But it's when you're sort of half in reality and not in reality, and you don't know which is which. That's the bit that I struggled with.
How were you eating? And were you able to eat, or you were intubated, so you couldn't, could you?
No, I couldn't. And I mean, they wouldn't even give me water. So I remember when I first woke up, all I wanted was a glass of water. I'd been in bed for three, and my mouth was parched. And it was only because one very sympathetic nurse decided that she was going to break protocol and give me a paddle pop stick with a sponge with water, and I could suck on that sponge. And that was the only water I could get.
Did that feel good?
Oh, it did, actually, surprisingly, yeah. It was only a couple of mils of water, but it was enough to moisten the lips a bit. But from a food perspective, you didn't eat. I just had a tube straight down into my stomach, and they had this super protein food that went nonstop into my stomach.
Did you have much of a sense of what was at stake for you at that point? Did you have a sense that, this is my whole life is going to be very different now, or I'm still at risk of death? Were you able to comprehend the enormity of what happened?
I think I was eventually. Yeah, I think I was a very annoying patient because I hate the loss of control. So I was always asking a lot of questions. They'd be giving me drugs. I'm like, oh, what's that drug? What's the chemical reaction that's creating? That's how is that helping me and how isn't it? And that's good. I've always, and that helps having a medical family as well, because they can often answer a lot of those questions.
You can distract yourself a bit and also feel like you have more control, even if you don't, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. But Yeah, I guess I shut my mind off. I'm very much, my family will tell you that I'm very much, you know, I love the ones I'm with. I'm very focused on a task and I'm oblivious to everything around me. And so getting healthy and recovering from this was a very single-minded venture for me. And so and because all the external stuff was being taken care of wonderfully by Kimberly and my family and my friends, I was able to just full-time job, okay, get better.
So you had a kind of a ladder of recovery or something that you thought that was climbable in your head? Is that what it was?
Yeah. Yeah. You do go through moments of doubt, of course, because it is long, slow process. You know, it takes a couple of years for the skin to stop contracting and that's the point where you're officially healed. But, yeah, it's just little milestones along the way. You know, first thing, be able to eat something or be able to have a drink. Next step, get up out of bed and walk. And the step after that, get out of the ICU and into the burns unit. And next step, go home. You know, and you had little goals along the way, and that's what kept me going.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So in hospital, you would have been introduced to a burns physiotherapist, a special one. How was your relationship with your burns physio?
Like all the other staff in the hospital, it was close. I suppose you can't be modest or prudish in the burns unit. Everything knows everything.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest role really is your physio, because he's the one that gets you walking. He or she is the one that gets you up walking and mobile again. Frank Lee was a wonderful man. He's a big Chinese guy, big lovable Chinese guy, and he's instrumental in getting me to where I am.
Yeah. How did he talk to you? How did he tell you about what the process would be like?
He didn't hide anything. He was from day one, and it was in intensive care still that he came in and visited me. He's like, "This is a little meet and greet. Hi, I'm Frank. You will call me your physioterrorist." and he was brutal, but you need to be, because you're essentially fighting the healing process in order to be able to maintain movement. And
what do you mean? What do you mean by fighting the healing process?
Well, when skin heals, it contracts, and that's fine, because it's pulling the open wounds together, but it's tightening the skin. And because the burns are such that I don't have elasticity in my skin anyway, over those points that bend, your fingers and your wrists and your elbows and shoulders and knees, you lose mobility because the skin's so tight. And so you're continually fighting against that, and you've got to keep stretching and stretching and stretching the skin until it's loose enough to be able to stretch over those joints.
Like, so to form the knobbly bit on your elbow, essentially.
Essentially, yeah.
So is that a painful process?
It is, because, it's very tender because it's just been operated on anyway, and it's still healing, and there's often still a lot of open wounds in there. But also, it's to keep it stretched, you're often re-tearing it. And so, the physio would be grabbing my hands and bending my knuckles to the point where every knuckle would split.
Wow.
And then hold it.
And even though the skin had split right at that point, to keep holding it.
Yeah.
So then how do they patch that up? Well, they just put Band-Aids on that or something.
And then you come back and you do it again the next day. And so, and then you do that for every joint that needs moving. The hands in particular were the worst, but, elbows and shoulders and knees were pretty brutal as well.
Did you need to learn to walk again then because of this?
Yeah, and a lot of that was just because I'd lost so much physical condition. And so I'd lost, despite this super protein they were feeding me on, I lost 14 kilos in a few weeks. And so you're very weak. And so,
what was using up all that energy on this high pressure?
It's just your body healing. It's just the metabolism running at a million miles an hour. It's like your temperature's stupidly high and your heart rate's stupidly high nonstop for a couple of months. And obviously that's going to burn a lot of energy and a lot of food, and they just keep pumping it into you.
So even though you're getting like weightlifter food, you're losing weight, were you? Right?
Very much so. Right. Yeah, yeah. Which I'm sure my wife was quite pleased about. But yeah, that's as trim as I've ever been.
Yeah, you should do that more.
I should do it more often. That's it's pretty brutal weight loss regime, but you know, I wouldn't recommend it. But if you're tough enough.
So Frank had to get you walking and bending the skin on your legs and stretching it on your knees.
All that. So he, every day he'd come in and we'd work on all the points that were needing work, and then we'd have a walk session and he'd stand me up. And initially it was just me draping my arms around his shoulder and him dragging me down the corridor and back. Then, I'd take a few steps, then I'd take a few steps by myself. And then eventually, a few weeks later, you're walking by yourself and then down the corridor, and it's little steps along the way, little milestones, as I said.
When I was in the Burns Ward, one of the things that you become aware of pretty quickly as a patient is there's a couple of people at least, no matter how bad you've got it, there's a couple of other people there in that ward, or maybe in a private room down the hall who's got it much worse than you. Did you have those conversations?
Yeah, you get to know them all pretty well. Because they're all going through the same thing, and you see them in the corridor as they're relearning to walk or not. And, there's some pretty horrible stories, and that actually gave me a lot of perspective as well. I was probably more extensively burnt than anyone else there. 70% is pretty high, as the doctors will tell you. The old rule of thumb is you add your burn percentage to your age, and that's your likelihood of dying. And I was 70% at age 27, so, there wasn't much chance of living. But, that all changed, of course, when Bali bombings had happened, and there was a big change in the quality of care for burns. But, there were people in there. There was a guy in there who was he tried to commit suicide, and he'd set himself alight, and his wife had just happened to come home early and found him alight in the backyard and saved him, and I don't think he really wanted to be saved. And so, therefore, you see, someone that's not just battling the burns, but also battling the mental issues that he had prior to the accident, and no doubt after the accident as well.
Fortunately, you're not facially disfigured in any way. I mean, so there was that too, I suppose.
Yes, and that's right. And that's a big thing from a psychological point of view, is when you look at yourself in the mirror and you're still the same person. And that's, I'm sure that would be a very big, very big obstacle to overcome.
So, I mean, sometimes you hear people say, I've learned to think of myself as lucky, and you think, that can't be right. But that is what happens then.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. I was lucky. I was lucky that it happened at work. So the cost of my recovery was largely paid for. I was lucky that I had, a very supportive family and friends and, a connection into the medical world so that they were ensuring that I had the best care. And I was lucky because I was fit and strong and healthy, and I was able to recover or go to my best efforts to recover.
Were there times when you thought you might not get your old life back?
There were, along the way. I'm very competitive. And so, the first couple of grafting operations when I was still unconscious, they went very well because I was still fit and strong and healthy at that point, but you're deteriorating as you go along. So by the time they got to doing my back, which was the last operation, the first graft didn't take, and then they had to do it again. And so you're going through the process and you're like, because I'm competitive, I'm like, I'm better than this. I can heal. Why can't I heal? And they're the moments that you think, okay, this, I might not get out of here. These wounds are never going to heal. This is an ongoing process. It's never going to happen, never stop happening. And so you get pretty down on yourself. The big change for me was actually when another guy who'd been burnt, he was a fireman, and he was burned about 5 or 6 years previously. He came back for a visit just to basically shake my hand, show me his scars and say, this is what it'll look like in 5 years. Hang tight. You'll come out the other side. And he actually married his physio terrorist.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but you were already engaged.
I was already engaged. But
Frank wasn't your kind of guy.
Look, in another life.
Right. So what was Frank's ultimate Burns Ward test to get you sort of ready to leave the hospital?
Oh, there were many, but the main one, the big goal was basically the Burns unit in Concord Hospital was on the 7th floor. And the big test at the end was if you could run from the 7th floor down to the ground floor and then back up again within 3 minutes, you were fine and you could leave the hospital. I had two attempts. The first attempt was I passed out on my way back up. I made it all the way down, then passed out on about the second or third floor on the way back up.
Passed out from what? From pain?
Exhaustion. So I just ran myself into the ground, yeah. I thought I was at rugby training and that I would, you know, I'd be able to break land speed records, and I, you know, I'd lost 14 kilos and I didn't have much stamina as it was. And then the second time, yeah, I did it in about 2 minutes 40 and... Yeah, I was quite proud of my time at the time, at that moment.
So 4 months to the day after the accident,
yeah.
You were able to return home to Singleton, mm-hmm. in New South Wales. What was that day like?
It's a combination of a lot of hard work. And that was, yeah, it was good. It was a little bit lonely because you'd had all these people around you all the time, and then suddenly it's just Kimberly and I again. And, yeah, I remember the trip home was great. I mean, it was lovely just to be able to have one-on-one with my wife rather than having so many other people around and then just, yeah, the emptiness of the house.
Yeah, because there's a whole culture in the Burns Ward.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you've all gone through the same thing to a different degree and you're all talking about it and it's kind of interesting too.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting, in fact, what's going on with everyone to more or less. So then you've got no one to talk to about it.
Yeah, and I mean, the Burns unit was a meeting point too. So I was often stuck in my room and we just had tribes of visitors coming from all over the countryside and from all my past lives and friends and family would come and drop in and wish me well. And so there's like this party in the waiting room. My parents were hosting it and my wife was hosting it. And I was actually a little bit jealous because I was stuck in bed and they'd come in and they'd all be joking about the beautiful dinner they had at Tetsu's the night before or something. And I strapped to a bed and with a tube down my throat, missing out on all the fun.
Yeah.
So leaving all that, it was a bit of a party atmosphere. And getting home, it was pretty quiet.
There's a really interesting moment when you have to be weaned off your pain medication. So you mentioned you were getting ketamine, and I'm guessing you're initially on tons of morphine and probably OxyContin, Endone, that sort of stuff as well.
Yep.
Because you do get a bit addicted to that.
You do.
And how did you wean yourself off and did you notice it?
Yes. How do I wean myself off it? In the same way I do everything, I do it head first. Cold turkey is how I did it. Yeah. So, I mean, I was decreasing the dose and I was doing everything that the pain specialists were telling me to do. And just got to a point where I was sick of relying on it. And it was almost like it was a remnant of the past that I wanted, I was moving on from my burns at that point. And so I wanted to disconnect myself completely with all memory of the hospital. And so, I went cold turkey, and that was, it was pretty brutal. Like, I was sweating and didn't sleep, and I'd have cold shakes. And
it's like the flu, isn't it?
It's like the flu.
It's
not pleasant.
and your morale crashes too.
Yeah.
Did you find that?
I did. Yeah, you do get, not depressed, but you do... It seemed hard again.
Yeah, because you've been getting better and better and better, and then suddenly everything, the things that had been, chemically propping you up, the props are kicked out.
Yeah, and I guess at the time you don't realise that they're propping you up either. I'd take an Endone and I think, well, this is doing nothing. But really it was, of course.
Yeah.
And you don't realise until you stop.
Until you stop.
Yeah.
Do you think, it's a really weird question to ask, but given the shocking injuries, the extraordinary pain, both in the accident and in the recovery. Are you traumatized or untraumatized by this accident? Are you getting nightmares about it? Are you badly troubled by it? Are you revisiting it, flashing back to it?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, the memory is a wonderful thing. You actually forget the worst of it. I remember the good times.
The good times, when you got burnt 70%
remember that
of your
time?
Body.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that, you know, a lot of good's come out of it and, you know, gives you a bit of notoriety and, you know, even from a business point of view, it helps. But
seriously, what do you mean by good has come out of it, though? I mean...
Oh, look, I think it changes your perspective on life. And I've said this before, but it's, you know, you do appreciate what you've got and what you haven't got, and you know, you're a little bit more relaxed about things, and think, you know, a little bit more confident that things will work out, and don't get quite so worked up about things that don't matter. And but even then, you know, you get stuck back into the daily rut of life, and you have to keep reminding yourself of where you've been, and you've got to keep reminding yourself that, yeah, life's pretty special, and we're very lucky to be here.
Yeah. You feel pretty good about the people who've been steadfast around you too?
Yes. Yeah, it brings you closer together. Yeah. I mean, Kimberly and I have always been pretty solid rock, but, yeah, it's different when your fiancée suddenly goes into a caring role as opposed to being just your wife. And so, yeah, there's an extra depth to your connection and relationship with your wife when that happens. It's pretty hard to describe.
So you went back to work at Drayton's Winery. That's amazing.
I did. People said I was mad. I said, how could you walk into the place again? I felt I had a bit of unfinished business in a lot of ways. I was stubborn. There was wines that weren't finished. So I felt like I had to go back and finish them off, not just for me, but for Trevor Drayton as well. And, it, you know, in a lot of ways it presented an opportunity. It was an opportunity to actually be the chief winemaker and make all the decisions and to maybe prove to everyone what I could do in a winemaking sense.
So, like, it's a bit of a cliche to say it's getting back on the horse, but to re-enter the place of this explosion, was it weird?
It was. Again, it was just another little wake-up call, you know, in the same way when waking up with bandages on was. It's you walk in and you see the place wasn't repaired much at that point. There was still... The building was a shell of a burnt building. And, so that kind of brought it all home and the reality of how big the explosion and the fire really was. Yeah, it was pretty emotional, yeah.
There was a coronial inquest years later which found that there were systemic failures of safety at the winery that caused the explosion there. How difficult was it for you? I mean, you obviously had to give evidence at that. Mm. Was it difficult for you to revisit?
Yeah, it's a bit annoying, actually. I mean, it's not annoying. It's a process that needs to happen. And, obviously I was a big part of the evidence of that as well. But it was for everyone, for the Draytons and for Eddie Orgo's family and for myself and my family, it's being dragged through it again. And it was territory that had been covered so much in that time. And we'd moved on. We'd even moved to Orange at that point. We were no longer in the Hunter Valley. And, yeah, it was... It's a test of the memory too, because in that time you kind of there's memory and then there's what you've learnt of all the stuff that you didn't know, and so you get asked questions and you start second guessing yourself. Am I remembering that, or has someone just told me that, or have I just deduced that since? And so it's a long time after an accident to be giving evidence at an inquiry that's so important. Yeah.
This is strange, but how did you find out your story had become an episode of All Saints, the Aussie soap? Hey? Was that a bit odd?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and they did it so well. I think I had a friend at the time who was working for Channel 7 at the time, and so she had suggested the idea of the episode to them and that it was going to happen.
Was the guy better looking or worse looking
than you? Much better looking.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
Yeah, but he didn't have a you know, a radio voice like me. It was inaccurate and it was all hearsay and, you know, dramatised to make it much more interesting than our story is.
So you moved to the Orange, like you said, to make a small-scale, cool climate wines there. What makes that area near Orange special for winemaking?
Oh, look, it's really about Mount Kinobolas. So it's about the altitude. And, I mean, Orange itself is the only region, think, in the world that's defined by altitude. So the actual border of the Orange wine region is the 600-metre in altitude line, and everything above that you can call orange on your wine label. But from a winemaking perspective, it's the varieties you can grow at that temperature and altitude, and, you know, it's the long, drawn-out, cold growing season, which then allows, a more complex development of flavours in the grapes,
yeah,
ultimately the wine.
I've often wondered this. Why do certain grapes like Pinot and Riesling and maybe Chardonnay grow better in the cold like that than they do, you know, in the middle of the Terra Rossa or the Barossa for some reason?
Yeah, I mean, they grow. And, I mean, grapes are a weed. They'll grow anywhere. But, yeah, in terms of, maybe it's partly because where they're traditionally grown, the styles of wines that are made from them, we've sort of now see those as what they should be. And so, therefore, if we're trying to emulate that, then we too have to grow it in a cold climate. They're also very early ripening varieties. So, you know, if you look from the other point of view, things like Cabernet, which ripens really late, we can't grow on our site on Mount Canobolas because you get to winter and the fruit was still not ripe. So, but yeah, it's like I said, it's the accumulation of, it's the cool nights and the warm days. We still have plenty of sunshine. So they ripen, but it's a different complexity of molecules, I suppose, that are being developed by the vine and the grape that end up in the wine.
Most winemakers I've met seem quite happy people to me. I mean, yeah, you grow this thing, presumably if you're making money out of them or you're getting by with it in any case. I mean, you make this thing, you grow it out of the earth, it takes time to make, it takes a lot of care and a bit of science and a bit of art and all those things. And the end result, you sort of pour out of a bottle and people like it. It's not that hard, really, in some ways, is it? It's quite a simple pleasure. Is it joyful for you to make wine?
It is joyful, yeah, because, I mean, I love drinking wine, but it's joyful because you can see a product. You know, it's very gratifying to, you know, work your way through a whole season, grow grapes, get them to the point where they're in perfect condition, perfect ripeness, pick them, and then transform that into a wine that, like you said, people are enjoying in a social environment.
Yeah, to go, try a bit of this, see how you like a bit of that.
That's
that
right. Kind of, and particularly when your name's on the bottle, you know, it's a long time coming, but it's a little bit embarrassing, but it is nice. Yeah.
Do you, I have to ask this, do you ever skate across the line of not spitting enough wine out when you're tasting? William, do you ever do that?
It's a hazard of the job. No, I do try to spit, and I'll tell you, a glass of wine at 7 o'clock in the morning at the start of the day actually is not that enjoyable. So you do a lot by nose. And if you do have to put it in your mouth, you tend to spit it because, yeah, certainly by lunchtime, it'd be pretty productive.
Unproductive
afterwards, yeah.
Such a pleasure to speak with you, William. Thank you so much for sharing,
Richard,
your story.
Thank you very much.
I spoke to Will Rickard Bell in 2018. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.